The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists annual convention and scientific sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the annual clinical assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. The ACOI REMS session is presented by Dr. Annette Karen.
So what I'm talking about this morning, I'm Annette Karen. I do geriatrics, internal medicine, palliative care for 20 plus years now. And I was part of the AOA's Committee on Council on Palliative Care Issues. And because of all the opioid crisis over the last 5 years or so, what this program came to be, CORE, REMS, appropriate long-acting opioid prescribing, the FDA said, you know what, we need to, physician education is part of it solving the crisis. So that all the, well, we can go through the slides here. Here's all the organizations that help support and help educate on this topic. So FDA gave money to a fund for these experts that were chosen in pain management to write this curriculum. And actually, as long as I've been prescribing my whole career, long-acting opioids, I learned a ton the first time I went through this slide deck. So there's a lot to learn, even if you are a pain management specialist. And I think some things that we don't usually learn are taught about long-acting opioid prescribing. But these docs got together, put these slides together, and those prior organizations that you saw got a grant to bring this curriculum to docs. So I've given this talk all over the country, as well as many other docs from the AOA, but many other organizations as well. Right now, and you guys are familiar with REMS, an example of what its resource education and mitigation strategies, it's put out to help protect the public, help us prescribe appropriately. An example of a REMS is for Accutane. If you want to prescribe Accutane, you have to fill out a whole disclaimer that helps support that it's an appropriate patient. Right now, this is optional, this course. But I truly believe with where things are going with the Opioid Council, the opioid issue, Tim McNichol and I from the ACOI went to the White House actually to sit on President Obama's, he had an opioid council to help solve prescriber issues. So I think this is gonna probably be mandatory within the next few years. So it's good that you guys are here attending this. Here's all the products that's covered. We don't go through every single drug. Like most of you, I have one or two, maybe three that I'm very comfortable with, and I don't really use the others except for very special situations. So if you see a lot of drugs mentioned that you don't know what they are, it doesn't matter. The most common one prescribed is long-acting morphine, and that's what we'll be talking about a lot, but there's all kinds of drugs. The most important thing is that you understand the drug, read the product information, and know side effects, et cetera, but we'll talk about that. So why are we here, okay? We can listen to the news or read an article or pick up a journal, and we know why this topic's important. Partly because of opioid deaths are growing, right? This is the trend of opioid deaths, treatment admissions, and prescribing. So the deaths and treatment admissions, of course, have been for misuse or abuse are going up tremendously because we're prescribing more as well. And I always get uncomfortable at this part because I was also in Michigan when I started practice. We were a triplicate state. Like, who remembers triplicate scripts? Right? So there was a huge push in Michigan that we were under-prescribing for pain. And when I was a resident, the patient would say, oh, you know, I need more pain medicine. And most of us learned pain management from the surgeons, right? When we did Demerol and Visceral in the hospital on everybody, and we prescribed them Vicodin when they left. Well, patients would say, I need something stronger. And the docs would say, well, I don't have the right prescription pad. So triplicate scripts, you had to go to the DEA, write the DEA and get a special pad delivered. So most docs didn't have it. So we were under treating pain. And that's where pain is the fifth vital sign came from, right? So now we got to find somewhere in the middle. Please don't use this talk saying you can't prescribe this. But we just have to prescribe them more cautiously. Unfortunately, I think where things are going, I've given this talk many places, and I've had lots of residents from all over the country come up to me and say, you know what, Dr. Karen, in my clinic, my attending's so tired of people coming in for pain medicine that they just made a blanket policy that they're prescribing no opioids whatsoever, which scares the heck out of me. The future of our internal medicine residents aren't going to know how to prescribe and treat pain. It really is scary to me. So don't take this too far the other way. So the number of overdose deaths involving opioids is growing as well. And here's a prescribing pattern. So you can look which state you're from and look at the number of opioid prescriptions per 100 people per year. Some are much higher than others. So this is what I was talking about in terms of under-prescribing. We get unresolved pain, okay? So we have to find some place in the middle. We over-prescribe and we get more adverse outcomes, deaths, treatment admissions, all this different side effects, respiratory depression. So, but with appropriate prescribing, we can get to adequate analgesia, and that's our goal. And you have to remember the goal of pain treatment is not zero. This, a lot of patients think 0 to 10 scale, well, my goal's zero. The goal, you have to define in your chart and for the patient and even for their family, what's their number? The goal might be 4, but the goal is not 0, and you have to say that up front. Adequate analgesia means they can function well with their chronic pain. And just to lay it out right up front, this talks about chronic pain. Long-acting opioids are not for acute pain, okay? There's the one thing about this talk and how they say adults learn is repetition, right? So there's a lot of things that will repeat, but the things that repeat are the key points in prescribing. But it's all about benefits versus risks. And I write this in my charts because I do geriatrics. Everything is benefits versus risks, every procedure, every med. But I write this in my chart every single day when I'm seeing a patient or when they come to the office, but benefit greater than risk of medication. You have an older adult on a long-acting opioid who falls, you have to evaluate their medication, but I just write in there, pain's controlled, more functional, benefit greater than risk of treatment at this time. That helps me in the nursing home meet the requirements for documentation for psychotropic or opioid prescribing in the nursing home and the hospital, but it's the benefits here are good analgesia, good function, better quality of life, and the risks are many. Drug interactions, abuse by the patient and or household members. You can get respiratory depression, but these are all small risks of appropriate prescribing. So this to me was so interesting. The source of most recent prescription opioids among past year misusers. So what an important term for you to understand here is a misuser and abuser, and we'll talk about that. But abuse means more intentional misuse of the drug. Misuse just means not necessarily following it as prescribed. But 54% of people who got their first prescription opioid bought from and taken from a friend or relative. Another 36% through prescription or stolen from a healthcare provider, 5% bought from a dealer or stranger in some other way. So this is the people that are misusing it. This is how they got their drugs. And you're probably sitting there thinking, oh, you know, this is 2% of my patient population. This isn't me. I had what I learned on this opioid council was the number one prescriber of opioids to teens are dentists. Okay, so I took my daughter to get her, she had some dental surgery, she was 16. He prescribed her 30 Norco or hydrocodone acetaminophen. Okay, she took one and said, oh, this makes me feel terrible, I don't want any more. Right, so what do I have sitting in my medicine cabinet? 29 hydrocodones. So, you know, a couple months later, what is my brother comes over and, God, my back's hurting so bad, as one of my husbands say, oh, here, why don't you take some of Vivian's hydrocodone, right? And I was like, wait, no, you can't do it. I mean, so that's how it happens. It's not even, that's why it's misuse. It's not intentional abuse, right? My brother wasn't drug seeking, he's like, here, take some of hers. We're not using them. That happens all the time. So first specific drug associated with initiation. So most, in terms of illicit drug use or inappropriate drug use, the first drug that most people try will be marijuana, but second to that is pain relievers. So this is why we're here, okay? So lots of federal organizations are involved, but we're here because of funding from the FDA. So any company that made long-acting opioids had to contribute to this educational fund. And these, I will give you guys at the end of this, there's a website that has all these slides. It has a lot of the tools that we'll be talking about. So there's no, you don't have to worry about writing down any of this. So the core statement or the goals here are misuse, abuse, diversion, addiction, and overdose has created a special public health epidemic. This course is not about educating or advocating that you use them or that you don't use them. Again, as we talked about, just that if you're going to use them, you prescribe them appropriately, because they can be an effective tool when prescribed appropriately. So here's our learning objectives. So I like this slide because it says your team. You have to get your staff on board in your office or the nurses in the hospital. I have just got a call yesterday of a patient. It's a hospice patient of mine who I have on 600 of long-acting morphine every 8 hours. But I've taken care of her for 2 years. She tolerates it well. She had to go in the hospital, and the nurses refused to give her that dose. I mean, they're just refusing to give it to her. So it doesn't even make sense to me. She was a little too sleepy one day, I guess, or something, but she's been on it for so many years. I haven't made a dose change in about 8 months. So it's not from the drug that she was sleepy, but your team, you have to have your office, your nurses on board with how you're gonna prescribe them, if you're gonna do urine drug testing, but we'll talk about that. But that's why it's important that you involve your whole team. So this slide I put in here just so that we remember all the different areas and how pain happens, right? We get an injury and it goes up our spinal cord into the brain. And that's where there's a lot of places along there where some addiction can happen because the brain really is involved. So physiologic stimulus, nociceptive and neuropathic. In terms of when I teach about pain, those are the two big things that I teach, the two different types of pains. Long-acting opioids are not first-line treatment for neuropathic pain, okay? That's a different talk, but if you think there's a neuropathic component, you might consider an adjuvant treatment for that to your opioids if you're using opioids as well. But opioids are not the first line treatment for neuropathic pain. But what we didn't do a good job of learning, at least me for sure in medical school, did not learn about the biopsychosocial spiritual context of pain. If you have a patient that you're just increasing their opioids and they're not getting better, they're coming back to the office, there may be a psychosocial component of the pain. Okay, don't forget about that. So there's just some examples of the different types of pain. And what is pain impact? How we sleep, how we move, so we get secondary physical problems, substance misuse, increased stressors, cognitive distortions, anxiety, depression. This is what chronic pain can do. And so, even chronic pain, acute pain in the hospital or pain in the untreated can cause the delirium. I do a lot of older adult treatment, of course. And patients come to the hospital and they're confused, so they stop. What do the house staff do? Stop their opioids. Well, pain can cause delirium too. So you really have to know your patient, know the balance, and know that there's complications from pain as well as risks with the medication. So if you're gonna treat pain, you have to have all of these different aspects, not just pharmacotherapy. And I don't know much about it, but I heard probably same as you on the radio, just on my travels here, that a lot of pharmacies are considering only allowing us to prescribe 7 days of opioids at a time, that the patient will have to get a new script. So there's a lot of different agencies making stopgaps to help themselves from worrying about people getting too many medications in the home, but to help us too. But there's some hearing that some insurance companies won't let you try long-acting opioids or prescribe them until you've tried some non-pharmacological interventions. But really, the appropriate treatment of pain is to start with non-pharmacologic interventions, if you can. You know, obviously, if it's a broken arm or an acute pain, you need something stronger. But OMT, cognitive behavioral therapy, even interventional treatment like nerve blocks, steroid injections, those are so underutilized in terms of referring patients to pain clinics for interventional treatment. I'm not qualified to speak on that, but it's something to think about. Okay, if there's a localized pain, they might be something they can block and decrease their need for long-acting opioids. Even every single patient, like for example, a pancreatic cancer patient that I see on the palliative care service, even newly diagnosed that's pursuing aggressive treatment, and even if they have little or no pain, I will tell them to go see the pain clinic just to establish a relationship, because sometimes a pain clinic might take a month or two to get in, and then they evaluate you, then they set you up for their test dose, and a lot of pancreatic patients, 2-3 months, if you wait 2-3 months to refer them when their pain's bad, they might not be able to handle going to all those appointments. So early on, I'm like, just get yourself established as a patient, and then they can do so well with celiac plexus blocks and doing any sort of GI end-of-life care, GI cancer end-of-life treatment. There's so much nausea, they have trouble taking pills, sometimes dysphagia, so you can't crush them. So any sort of nerve blocks you can do may reduce the need for opioids down the road, or certainly lessen the need for opioids. And then certainly acupuncture, if you're going to use pharmacotherapy, we start with non-opioid treatment. Okay, so NSAIDs, but obviously those you have to prescribe appropriately, but antidepressants might be good for if there's a neuropathic component. Topicals, I think, are grossly underutilized. A lot of my older adults in the nursing home, I might schedule 500 milligrams of Tylenol in a hot pack twice a day for their pain, for especially osteoarthritis pain. So there's a lot of interventions, but there's an expectation today that you'll try non-pharmacological interventions before you go to pharmacological. And we have to involve the family in all of this together, because it gives them something to do to buy into their pain, but it'll improve their quality of life. So this program is broken up into chapters here, and at the end of each one, there's some pearls. So explain the neurophysiology of pain process to patients. So explain it to them when patients understand their concerns are validated and that there's multi-components to pain. Here's an example of a patient. Is this misuse or abuse? Your patient requests an early refill for the second time in 6 months. Took extra medications for headache and again for toothache. Prescription is for lower back pain. So is this abuse or misuse? It's misuse, right? Taking it for an indication that it wasn't prescribed for. Not necessarily drug-seeking, not, you know, inappropriate use to get high, which might be abuse, but using it for other things. Patients might take a pain medicine because they can't sleep. That's misuse, okay? So for your action here would be confirm patient's understanding of each medication's dosage, time of day, maximum daily dose. Even the patient who's trying to wean themselves off, right? They take one less because their pain's not so bad. That's a misuse, because then they might create withdrawal symptoms, or they might get a spike in their pain that they can't control now when they take the next dose, thus creating a situation where they need more breakthrough, and then you might increase it just because they tried to skip one dose. That's misuse. But find out what your patients understand about the medication. Sometimes a patient might not be a candidate for long-acting opioid because they can't understand how to take it. Or if there's any cognitive impairment, you have to be super worried that they take the appropriate dose, number of pills, et cetera. So how do we assess pain? I don't spend a long time on this part because we learned this great in medical school, right? For chest pain, does it radiate? Are you sweaty? Are you short of breath? What makes it better? What makes it worse? What I show this for and what I talk about it is in my charts, even with shoulder pain, that's clearly osteoarthritic, or knee pain that's clearly osteoarthritic, I still write all of these things down. You want to assess the pain the same way every time. What makes it better? What makes it worse? What have you tried before? And that's, if you're, it's about documentation. If you document appropriately that you've tried these other interventions, you understand the process of pain, you have a diagnosis, then you can gradually work your way up through treatment to appropriately prescribe long-acting opioids. I think a lot of docs are afraid they're gonna get reported if they prescribe too many, but if you've tried all these steps and you're documented appropriately, it's very appropriate to use long-acting opioids. But, and you can have your staff even ask all these questions if someone's coming in for a pain. You know, write it in your, it's right in, you can set up your EMR to have these questions right in there. So what is their treatment history? That would be super important. What have they taken before for it? And specifically ask about over-the-counter and non-pharmacologic treatments, because you want to document those. And I'm, although we don't have, I know we have some literature on acupuncture, but we don't have a lot of literature in terms of treatment pain and outcomes in terms of things like aromatherapy, guided imagery. But if somebody wants to try something, I say have at it. But just let me know if you're going to do a herbal supplement, just so we can check for drug interactions. And we know that our patients listen a lot more to Dr. Oz than they do to us. So they, and let me know if the, if they can take what they want, as long as they're taking what I prescribe them as well. So that, just ask, you have to specifically ask a question about non-pharmacologic or over-the-counter medications. And then any past opioid use, certainly current use, query your state PDMP program, which we'll talk a little bit more about, and then certainly what they're taking, how, what dose, how often they take it. You got to write all of that down. And then past medical history, I mean, you guys know how to do that, but specific illnesses that might be linked to possible substance abuse disorders, if they have had hepatitis, HIV, tuberculosis, cellulitis, potentially at an injection site. Those are some, these are some histories that might be important. And cardiac or pulmonary disease might affect how you prescribe it. But if they've had an endocarditis potentially at some point in the past, might be an indication that they might have had some IVDA use. So you want to get specifically these questions in your history if you're considering prescribing long-acting opioids. So risk factors for opioid abuse, controlled medications prescribed or non-prescribed, alcohol and tobacco use, history of sexual abuse, family history of substance abuse and psychiatric disorders, or age 16 to 45 years old. So just that alone is a risk factor. And I'm not telling you these so we discriminate against these patients or that you don't prescribe them that. We don't want to judge. Somebody who has a history of IVDA is going, at some point is going to potentially have significant chronic pain, and they deserve opioid treatment. But you just want to know, this is not discriminating. This is a simple data-proven fact that if they have any of these risk factors, they're higher use risk of abuse of the drug. Okay? And then their social history down there as well. Any trouble with employment, trouble with the law, et cetera. So, and then physical exams, of course you do a full physical exam, but specifically look for potentially areas of, you know, tracts in the arm where they might have injected things with some cutaneous or trophic findings, gait and posture, percussion, auscultation, a neurological exam, and cognitive exam is important because, again, can they take the medication appropriately? Okay. So risk assessment tools, there's some on the CORE website, but you can Google this term itself. You should have in your office, just pick one. This is a list of all the different kinds of opioid risk assessment tools. So you, this could be part of your packet that you give patients when they come to the office that they fill in the waiting room, or your staff could easily be trained to do it. Some of them are patient, they fill it themselves, some are staff administered. Here's an example of one opioid risk tool. So they check the box, different points for male or female, and if they have a family history of it, a personal history of it, of course their age, pre-adolescent sexual abuse, and psychological disease. Just adding those up will assess the risk of opioid abuse. You're not doing this so you say, oh, you scored a 7, you can't get it. It just means you're gonna go a little more cautiously, get a specialist involved sooner, maybe look at adjuvant treatments more than opioids, or certainly get a team involved. Refer them to psychology right away if you think that there's a risk of abuse, but you could still prescribe it, but get more resources sooner before they start having problems. This is just information on another type of test or screening tool. There's so many different kinds and so many different questions, but just find one that you're comfortable with for your office. So there's a lot of overlap here between opioids, pain, and addiction. One doesn't necessarily mean the other. For non-cancer patients, up to 30% the risk of opioid use disorder. And again, that could be misuse or abuse. Always highest with past history of substance use disorder or psychiatric comorbidity, and patterns may shift with age, okay? So pain, there's analgesia, you look at activities and function, watch for aberrant behavior, watch for adverse effects, and their affect in terms of taking the medication. But addiction really is loss of control, compulsive use. Even when they get it, they're searching for their next dose, craving the drug, continued use despite improvement of the problem, and it's certainly chronic. So it's just a way of looking at the difference between pain and addiction. So these are the tools that you want in your office. PDMP, you're in drug, PDMP is your prescription drug monitoring program for your state. You can get access in your state. Some states allow access if you live in a border state to the other state. Your office staff can access it too if you just have to enroll them. Urine drug testing we'll talk about, and then your risk assessment tool that we already talked about, and then your pain assessment tool. So there's, you don't have to recreate the wheel in anything here. So when would you consider a trial of an opioid? So you've already done your good history and physical, you've looked at non-pharmacologic options, and there's benefits are likely to outweigh the risk. So their function's still impaired from their pain. It's a chronic pain, you have a diagnosis, they're failing other interventions. Pain is moderate to severe. So, you know, on a scale potentially 5 to 8, somewhere like that, on a scale 0 to 10, how you prescribe opioids is you trial an initial of immediate release opioids. And sometimes when I give this talk, I think, oh, gosh, all these docs probably know this so well. You know, how much is this preaching to the choir? But I just started it, I changed jobs a few months ago, and I do geriatric consults and geriatric trauma. And we had a patient who was on chronic opioids, 15 of MS-Contin Q12 hours. We increased it to 30 in the hospital acutely because he came in with a hip fracture. Well, one day he was a little sleepy. So the trauma patients are admitted to surgeons, right? Which is fine. I'm not dissing surgeons, but he was a little sleepy one morning. So the surgeon said, he stopped the morphine completely and put him on a 50 mic patch of fentanyl. This was 2 weeks ago. So sometimes when I give this talk, I think, gosh, we know this. There's so much information out there. We go to CME. Do docs really need this? And I just thought, this is scary. I would probably say twice a week, I see really malpractice type prescribing of opioids, no matter which hospital I've been at, from really good internists. It's because we don't understand it. It's because we're more comfortable with a patch than a pill. Morphine scares us as much as it does families. So it's really important for you to understand how to prescribe. These times are changing. We can't just throw on a fentanyl patch. And for those of you that might not know, a 50 mic fentanyl patch is equal to 100 milligrams a day of morphine. So the patient was on 60 total daily, and he was worried about that. So we put him on a 50 mic patch, which wasn't going to even start working for 24 hours. Right? So the patient was at risk for withdrawal for the 24 hours that he stopped his morphine and put on the fentanyl and create a whole other kind of chaos in terms of delirium. Just all I'm saying is if you walk out of here, next time you write for an opioid, think, do I know the half-life? Do I know what I'm prescribing this for? What's my long-term plan for this patient? Okay? But you initiate, after you've done everything else, you initiate a trial of immediate release opioids. So when to consider a trial. So obviously we have two patients here, pretty dramatic difference, but 60-year-old with chronic disabling osteoarthritic pain, non-opioid therapy is not effective, no psychiatric medical comorbidities or personal family drug abuse history. High potential benefits relative to potential risks. Could prescribe opioids to this patient in most settings with routine monitoring. So who would be comfortable prescribing for osteoarthritic pain? And this guy, okay. So it's very appropriate. The literature on treating osteoarthritis says it's appropriate, but you would start potentially. For me treating this patient, I would start with scheduled Tylenol. I would do topicals. I would have tried injections, physical therapy, certainly any topicals. And if that was failed and it was really interfering with function, you would start with something like hydrocodone, maybe 5 milligrams twice a day, or 5 milligrams just at bedtime, or five, or right before activity. But scheduled, and something for breakthrough. And sometimes I'll use hydrocodone 5 milligrams twice a day and then use extra strength Tylenol for breakthrough. Try that, or then you can use the hydrocodone for breakthrough too. But you'd start with immediate release. But it would be appropriate to use it in this gentleman. So our younger patient here, 30-year-old with fibromyalgia, recent alcohol use disorder. I hate this slide because fibromyalgia patients get such a bad rap, I think, because we just don't know how to treat it. But opioid treatment is not appropriate for fibromyalgia, right? That's come through the whole process of pain management. But she has a history of abuse, younger age, a clear diagnosis that opioids are not the first line of treatment. She would not be a good candidate for opioid therapy. So just some examples here. So when you initiate opioids, in the CDC guideline, again, you'll have these slides, but I would print this, read it. These are the guidelines and the standard of care for treating pain. So you begin with an immediate release, prescribe the lowest effective dose. Know that some drug, a fentanyl patch now comes in 12.5 mics, or 12 mics. You don't have to start with 25 if you're gonna use that drug. Know what dose the medications come in. Prescribe the lowest effective dose. Use caution at any doses, but particularly when you're increasing the dose to more than 50 morphine milligram equivalents a day. You have to watch a little bit more for respiratory depression, a little bit higher doses. For acute pain, lowest effective dose of immediate release, no more than needed. No long-acting opioids for acute pain. We already talked about that. And then reevaluate regularly, every 1 to 4 weeks, depending on the patient. Certainly at initiation of dose, I would have them come back in a week. And then again, how I told you guys about documenting. Patient tolerating well, benefits greater than risks at this time. Because even if they're doing great on it, there's still risks with it, right? So you want to document that, benefits greater than risks at this time. And then there's a link to the guideline there. So informed consent, when initiating a trial of opioid analgesic therapy, confirm the patient understands. This is all the things that you're gonna wanna help document that they understand. You've talked to them about how to manage adverse effects, and there's forms out there for informed consent that address all of this, that you can go through with them and give them, and you just check, gave them the prescribing information and use information for this long-acting opioid. But what are their expectations for the medication? Again, that would be, what's their goal for pain, for example? Tell them the risks that you've talked about, the alternatives. And you talked about adverse events with long-term therapy as well. But when you're starting a drug, what is my long-term plan? So a patient prescriber agreement is what I was telling you about, is part one of your tools that you can have in your office. That it's a document signed by both you and your patient to clarify the treatment plan and goals, assist in patient education, discuss medication safe handling, storage, and disposal, which we'll talk about, and then document patient prescriber responsibilities. So this would be, you'd have in there a clause about how you both can get out of it, right? If you don't do these things that I say as your doctor, I'm gonna not prescribe these anymore, I may discharge you from my practice. It's straight up front in a patient prescriber agreement. And also what the patient's expectations of you are. You know, one of the most common things in these is you will only get medications from me, you will only get them from one pharmacy. But their expectation is that you'll be available Monday through Friday, let's say. You know, so you have to come up with some plan if you're going away for a 2-week vacation, something like that. That would be your responsibility. But their responsibility, you could clearly outline whatever you're comfortable with. So here's some examples of what are in patient-provider agreements. One prescriber, one pharmacy, that you'll store the medications, lock them from children in your home. You understand how to dispose of them appropriately, and that you'll follow up regularly, that I might be doing random urine drug testing on you to make sure you're taking the medication, how to get refills. Identify behaviors for discontinuation, which one might be if you use these for other than the appropriate indication, such as for sleep or if you share them. And what's our exit strategy? One for, there has to be a plan that your pain might get better and we're going to reduce the medication, or an exit strategy if this agreement is broken. So it can, you want to monitor adherence and aberrant behavior. So we'll talk more about this, but you want, there's some ways to check that they're taking the medication appropriately. Pill counts, again, using your PDMP, urine drug testing, family member or caregiver interviews. That might be part of your patient agreement that I'm going to talk to your family about how you're using the medication. And then your monitoring tools. Those are some examples of different monitoring tools out there that you might have them fill out when they come to the office. And then pill counts, which I mentioned. So behavior outside the boundaries of agreed on plan. So certainly misuse behaviors might be on the left there, which we've kind of talked about quite a bit already, but unsanctioned dose escalations might be a type of misuse, but certainly abuse behavior, multiple dose escalations are non-compliant despite warnings, prescription forgery, non-medical sources. Those are things that you might say that's an exit, I'm out of it if you're doing stuff like that, because that's abuse. And I live in Detroit, 15 minutes I can be in Canada, okay? In Canada they sell codeine over the counter. So, and there's drugs available on Craigslist and on the internet too. So it's from non-medical sources, there's a lot of places to get opioids. So we talked about documentation and how important it is. Document, like I said, your good history, your plan for prescribing it, your plan for following it, a plan for the exit strategy, and constantly risk greater than benefit. They're able to go to work. They're able to meet their goal of function to do physical therapy. Whatever your goal for treatment is, you're documenting that they're meeting that goal. So our summary here in this section, conduct a comprehensive history and physical, risk for abuse, determine if therapeutic trial is appropriate, establish realistic goals, and document everything. So determine if a therapeutic trial would be when you start the immediate release opioids and see how they respond to it, see if it improves their function. You may do the therapeutic trial and the adverse events are too high, they're not following the rules that you agreed on to take it, or it's simply not helping. Okay, so those are what a therapeutic trial is for. So another red flag here, Ms. Jones says she needs opioids to manage her pain until she can have surgery. She reports continued delays in getting to surgery. You phone the surgeon and discover that no date has been set and that she has canceled several appointments. Okay, so you might not think much about is something going on with this patient, but she's set a time limit and expectation. So you communicate, you realize that potentially she's not ever planning to have the surgery and she may just want to keep getting the opioids, but you offer, you say, I'm gonna do this for one more month, you have to have the surgery set up or I'm not doing it anymore. So you wanna communicate with other docs. There's a lot of patients where they're getting opioids from their PCP, they're getting opioids from the cardiologist, I just need a quick refill on this doc, and we're not really talking to each other, so you wanna talk to each other. Non-pharmacologic, you don't have to abandon the patient, but offer non-pharmacologic interventions, non-opioid interventions, and then communicate with the surgeon to say, this is going on, let's get her into surgery, or let me know if she never goes. All right, so chapter 5, management, monitoring, and discontinuing. So opioid side effects, I think we're all pretty aware of these. Respiratory depression is the most serious, but also the most rare. If you start with short-acting opioids, appropriate dosing, and titrate them up, the risk of this is very small. This is probably my biggest argument in this slide deck, is they stress this so much. When we were residents, John and I, trained together, and we were, everybody that we saw that had any respiratory rate of 8, you'd give them a whole amp of Narcan, right? And I've put so many people into a pain crisis, right, because we're so worried about respiratory depression and opioids. It really only happens with acute pain, acute opioid prescribing, most likely with acute, and then big doses. So a patient who's opioid naive and they get 2 adilaudid, let's say, IV or hydromorphone, which is equal to 10 milligrams of morphine all at once. Now, you can get respiratory depression from long-acting opioids, but it might be only at the very beginning. But if they've already been on immediate release, it's much less likely. And if you're prescribing it appropriately and watching them closely, it really shouldn't be a big problem. So opioid-induced constipation is the most common and will always be part of their life if they're getting opioids, but we can treat it. Sedation, cognitive impairment, falls, fracture, sweating, meiosis, urinary retention. Many of these are certainly less frequently. Hypogonadism usually is with much longer use. Tolerance, physical dependence, and hyperalgesia, again, with longer use. Addiction in the vulnerable patient. So respiratory depression, I think this is where a lot of the deaths are coming from, but a lot of the deaths are coming from misuse. They're crushing. You know, you can't crush long-acting opioids, but if they're crushing them and taking them, then they become immediate release. And it's like that big bolus dose and can cause respiratory depression. But if early on, if you're prescribing your long-acting opioid, you might want to have the patient supervised. So if you're starting it in your office, have someone stay with them for a couple days. So you can watch this at the beginning, so the greatest risk initiation of therapy after increased dose. Usually there's, of course, shallow breathing, CO2 retention. Instruct patient and family, if you see any of this, call 911, okay? They shouldn't try to wait it out. It's more likely in elderly, cachectic, or debilitated patients. It's contraindicated in patients with respiratory depression or conditions at increased risk. So it's not a hard contraindication in patients that might have COPD. In fact, we know some of the guidelines in treatment for heart failure are some opioid prescribing actually help sometimes, especially at the end stages. But COPD, I use long-acting opioids sometimes in my COPD patients in hospice, but if it's appropriate prescribing, but you do have to be much more careful in patients with any respiratory disease at all. If it's given with other drugs that affect the respiration, benzodiazepines, for example, you gotta know what other drugs your patients are on, what other drugs other docs are prescribing. And certainly opioid naive, we don't start long-acting opioids on patients that are opioid naive. Okay, you just don't. You got that? No long-acting opioids on patients that are opioid naive. You start with immediate release and then titrate them up, okay? So reduce the risk, proper dosing and titration. Don't overestimate the dose, err on the side. If you're looking at an equal analgesic table, err on the lower dose. Instruct patients to swallow tablets, capsules whole. You cannot crush them. I had a patient in the nursing home who, and this was as much my fault as the nurses, but on OxyContin, and was having this waxing and waning mental status, lethargy. They couldn't wake him up sometimes, but the patient had a PEG tube, but could swallow. In fairness to me, then I thought I wrote for the OxyContin oral, but the nurses said, "Oh, you know, they should have PEG tube. Let's put it through the PEG tube." So they'd crush it and put it through the PEG tube. So the patient was getting a big dose of oxycodone at once, and then it would wear off, and then they'd be in pain, so they'd be up, and then they'd be sleepy. They were getting it twice a day, but it took me probably a week or so of them calling me to try to figure out what was going on. So you cannot crush these medications ever, okay? If your patient can't swallow, you have to come up with something different. You have to switch them off the drug. So when to move from immediate release to long-acting, maintain stable blood levels. So the idea for pain management is their pain is at a level that's tolerable, and occasionally they'll have a spike. Maybe with activity, maybe first thing in the morning, something like that. And then they take a short acting when they reach that spike. If they have a good steady state of pain management, when they take the as needed medication, it treats it well and brings them back to that state. If we're just doing PRNs and they wait to take it, or when the pain gets bad, their pain's up here, then it gets up here, then they take it and it doesn't quite get back to where it was. So then it's controlled. Then when they have a spike, it goes up here. And they're way up here now, and then the medicine doesn't work anymore. And then they appear to be drug seeking. Well, I'm giving you the hydrocodone that worked last week. Well, now it's not working. So more steady state is the idea between long-acting opioids. And a lot of times, I'll just start somebody on 15 of long-acting morphine at bedtime. Because the short-acting opioids work for 4 to 6 hours. If they sleep more than 6 hours, they wake up with no opioid in their system. the long-acting, if it's chronic pain, the long-acting will work for 12 hours and kind of help them sleep better. And then when they wake up, their pain's not so high, and that immediate release PRN med can help kick in. So stable blood pressures, longer duration of action, multiple immediate release doses to achieve effective analgesia. So it's not sustainable for a patient to manage their pain taking a dose every 4 hours. Somebody that's trying to work or sleep or function, having to live by the clock if their pain's not well controlled, you want to switch them to long acting. So there's poor analgesic efficacy despite increasing dose. You're increasing the dose of the immediate release, but it's not helping. Less sleep disturbance, like which we talked about, they sleep better. And then other reasons a patient's ready to try something different, a little bit easier to take, cost or insurance issues, adherence issues. They have trouble taking the medication every 4 hours, maybe cognitive issues. So a 72-hour patch might be more beneficial. So depending on, it's certainly individual patient prescribing. Change in clinical status requires an opioid with different pharmacokinetics, and then drug-drug interactions. So there's a lot of different reasons why you might look to move from immediate release to long-acting. So considerations for change, select the right dose. The patient's pharmacy pays for it. Again, their dysphagia issues, drug allergies, other meds that they're on, et cetera. Monitor initially closely for respiratory depression, and then titrate up slowly and individually. And they, even if you start them on long acting, they should have something short acting for breakthrough. And I get called invariably, now I think it's getting better because it's probably down to once a month, but it used to probably be twice a week where I'd get a nurse or a family would call me and say, they're not treating his pain. And I'd call the nurse and, well, I gave him his MS-Contin at 9 a.m. Well, that's not going to kick in for 4 to 6 hours, right? So they can have their long-acting and their short-acting at the same time. So the nurses were uncomfortable giving them that. So the patient was in a lot of pain until that long-acting kicked in. But you always want to make sure you, if you prescribe something long-acting, they have something short-acting for breakthrough as a supplement. So this, to me, is the most eye-opening for you, okay? What's opioid tolerance? So you when I say opioid naive, we don't prescribe long-acting to opioid naive. This is opioid tolerant. So for at least a week, they've been on 60 milligrams of oral morphine a day, 25 microgram transdermal fentanyl an hour, 30 milligrams oral oxycodone a day, 8 milligrams oral hydromorphone, 25 milligrams oral oxymorphone, or an equal analgesic dose of this for at least a week. So you see, even if they've been getting this, you still have to be careful with the long-acting opioid, but all of those side effects are going to be a lot less, and certainly respiratory depression is going to be a lot less risk if they're opioid tolerant. And some of the long-acting medications specifically say in their prescribing information, only prescribe in opioid-tolerant patients. Okay? And you think about how could someone be on 60 milligrams of oral morphine a day? A lot of times I use the oral morphine concentration 20 per one, 20 milligrams per cc concentration. The trade name is Roxanol. And I might do 5 milligrams every 3 hours as needed at first, or every 4 hours as needed, and then it might go up to 10 milligrams if that's not working, and then if that's, they're using that. So 10 milligrams every 4 hours would be 60 milligrams a day, okay? So you can get there very quickly from using your PRN short-acting medications. Opioid rotation is really kind of a lecture in itself, but what you have to understand what it is. If a patient's not tolerating one, it's a change from one opioid regimen to another with the goals of improving therapeutic outcomes. So somebody's not tolerating one drug. Somebody's not, their pharmacy won't cover one drug. So you have to do an opioid rotation. What the issue is you have to be careful. You have to understand equal analgesic dosing. You have to watch for side effects. And they may be more responsive to one medication than the other, so you're going to reduce the dose when you rotate the opioid. But we'll talk about that. Equal analgesic dose tables. And this slide is interesting to me, too, because I've lived by these. There's an app you can get on your phone. You can just type in the drug they're on and the drug they're going to with the dose, and it'll tell you what to change them to. But you want to decrease it by 25 or 50% depending on the patient. But there's many different equal analgesic dose tables, and I didn't really appreciate this, again, until I saw this slide deck. They don't always have the exact same equivalents. They might include oral but not topicals. They might not include IV conversions. So understand your drug conversions. And I ask residents all the time, how many people have written for 5 milligrams of IV morphine this week? And almost nobody ever raises their hand, okay? But how many of you written for 1 milligram of Dilaudid? And almost everybody. That's probably one of the most misunderstood drug conversions. Even in the hospital, the nurses will say, I'll come in the morning and I'll have written for 5 of morphine IV, and the nurse will say, well, they were a little sleepy, so I gave them 3, right? Which they can't do that, that's not. But it seems to be an accepted practice with nursing. They're supposed to call, right? I'm uncomfortable giving this dose. But I'll say, all right, well then just switch them to 1 milligram of Dilaudid. And they go, okay. So, which is, it's exactly equal analgesic dose. But to me, that's one of the most misunderstood. But know your table, know your conversion, use the same one. Don't switch between different tables. Here's an example of one. Morphine here, the sub-Q to IV is 3-1 across the board. And then down 10 milligrams of morphine is equal to 1.5 milligrams of hydromorphone, which is Dilaudid. That's how you use those tables. This is why that somebody might say, oh, you know, I'm allergic to this one, or I can't take this one, or this one causes problems. But you think if they have respiratory depression or problems with morphine, how can they take hydromorphone? Well, it's because of mu receptors, and everyone's mu receptors are a little different. It helps explain the variability in response depending on their mu receptors and depending on their saturation of their receptors. And what I see at the hospital I used to work at, their post-op orders for hips and knee replacements actually had right on their standing orders IV morphine PRN, tramadol PRN, or Ultram, and hydrocodone PRN. So 3 different opioids in the standing orders. Okay, so I just only left there 3 months ago. So what's a nurse gonna do? Oh, they're having pain, let's try an Ultram, okay, or tramadol. Okay, that didn't work, let's try hydrocodone. And then, okay, that didn't work, let's give them morphine, right? Well, what's happening to the mu receptors? They're getting saturated, so you get more drug, less able to bind to treat pain, and more drug circulating in the system, causing delirium, respiratory depression. You really should never, ever, ever need more than 2 opioids to treat a patient. Okay? And when I say more than 2, the preference would be 1. I most commonly prescribe long-acting morphine and short-acting immediate-release morphine for breakthrough. Because there's no ceiling dose, there's different routes for the drug, but sometimes in a drug like a fentanyl patch, you're gonna have to use a different drug for breakthrough because the short-acting fentanyl is Actique, which is a lollipop, which is really hard to find. It's very expensive. I've only written for it a few times in my whole career, so I have to use something different for breakthrough if you're using fentanyl patch. But ideally, you use the same drug, long-acting and short-acting, okay? So guidelines for opioid rotation. So if you're gonna switch them to another drug, if you look here, closer to 50% reduction if the patient's receiving a high dose of current opioid regimen or they're elderly or frail. But what that means is you calculate the equal analgesic dose and reduce it by 50% and start them at that dose. If they don't meet those criteria, you go closer to a 25% reduction. But I almost always do a 50% reduction, especially unless I'm going to change route of administration. So I'm going from IV morphine to oral, then I'll do more of a 25% reduction. But I often mostly practice to 50% because you just don't know how the patient's gonna tolerate the drug. They might tolerate it much better and need less drug. So in methadone, you can't use standard equal analgesic dosing tables. I think you have, my heart rate goes up prescribing methadone even though I've done it a whole lot. It's just so long acting. The half-life is so long and it can have QT, cause QT changes, so you gotta be careful with drug interactions. You're gonna see it a lot more, and I use it a lot more because it's cheap. You can use it long-acting, short-acting, and it's really good for neuropathic pain. So I use it a lot, mostly in my hospice patients, but even in the hospice I work for, unless you've done this full-day course that they put on, regardless of your history of training or anything, Anytime you make a methadone change, you have to call the national pharmacist. That's how tough this drug is to prescribe, and the risk is so high. I've often admitted a patient that's on hospice at home to the hospital to initiate methadone just because the risks are so high of respiratory depression, delirium, side effects when you start it. But be very careful if you're going to prescribe it, but it doesn't mean you can't. Just really be cautious and get some training on how to prescribe it. And look at your package inserts, really, or the product information for prescribing the patches. So this is just a summary of what we've already talked about. You calculate the equal analgesic dose and automatically reduce the dose. Watch, frequently assess for initial response. How's the pain being treated? Are they having adverse events? And then always remember to give your rescue dose. So the breakthrough dose is usually 5 to 15% of your total daily dose, which I just keep in my head 10%. So I calculate their total daily dose of long-acting opioid and write for 10% dose PRN for breakthrough. So breakthrough pain, we kind of already talked about a little bit. You don't use a long-acting opioid for breakthrough pain. Long-acting opioids should never be PRN. I mean, I was embarrassed. I taught all the residents at my other hospital, and I would still see a third-year medicine resident who spent a month with me write for PRN long-acting morphine. I mean, it takes too long to kick in. It's not appropriate. And if your patients are using it as needed, that's a misuse, okay? So you use something short-acting for breakthrough. Don't forget your non-opioid and non-pharmacologic treatments as well. So just because you're switching somebody to opioid, don't forget they might need their neuropathic pain treatment. They might still need their topical Asper cream or whatever you're using, their guided imagery. All of that's going to reduce the amount of opioid that they need. If you have patients that have substance abuse disorders, here's some websites that are good across the country to look for substance abuse treatment facilities. And refer, if you can, I know a big issue, I've given this talk enough, that a lot of docs have come up to me that pain management isn't always the best answer because, one, they don't have open spots, two, they make a treatment recommendation and then send them back to you to do the prescribing, or it's not interdisciplinary. The best pain management center is going to be interdisciplinary, where they have staff to do all the non-pharmacological interventions as well. So hopefully psychology or psychiatry involved as well. So because it doesn't mean that they're pathologically psychiatric illness because they have chronic, because they have chronic pain, it's a lot of psychological stress. So you're going to get the best treatment with an interdisciplinary pain clinic. So we'll talk a little bit about urine drug testing. It's done for the patient, not to the patient. So this isn't something that we'll have to get out of the mindset in our offices of doing this on the patients that were just worried about abuse. Do it on your 90-year-old little old ladies and your 30-year-old IBDA patients. You have them do it, and you just tell them it's part of your contract, your prescriber-patient agreement. It's to help them. Sometimes the patient might be getting pressure and someone's stealing their drug and they're afraid to tell you. But so there might be things you can do help for the patient, not to the patient. That's the important thing here. It helps identify drug misuse and addiction, and it helps you assess and documenting adherence. So it's just another tool to say, yes, they're appropriate to continue. Benefits greater than risk. They're taking it appropriately. There's all different reasons for it. What I left this slide in, I almost pulled it out because I'm not really qualified to talk about all the different immunoassays and things. The important thing about this is to know that there's different types of urine drug testing. If you're looking for a drug and it's not there, and you really think the patient's compliant, call the lab and say, do you even test for this drug? Because some drugs are synthetic and it's not tested. So know which type of assay they're doing and what they test for. For most drugs, it's 1 to 3 days that it's going to be show up in a urine drug testing. But all different things, chronic use of lipid-soluble drugs might increase the detection, and some other things might decrease the detection. Okay, so that's where you want to talk to your lab. So a positive result demonstrates usually demonstrates recent use. Most drugs have, 1 to 3 days if they've taken it in that time. And then does not diagnose drug addiction if they're taking it and a physical dependence or impairment, right? So just because it's in their urine and you didn't prescribe it doesn't necessarily mean that they're addicted, right? It just might mean that they couldn't afford the one you prescribed them, and so they borrowed their neighbor's or something like that. But it could mean misuse, but it doesn't necessarily mean an addiction. And it doesn't give enough information to show exposure time, dose, or frequency of use. So just because it shows up doesn't mean they're taking it exactly as they said or exactly as you prescribed it. A negative result does not automatically diagnose diversion, right? We'd be concerned if it's not showing up in their urine that they might be selling the drug or giving it away. But it possibly could mean that they're running out early, that they're taking extra doses so they had some time without it. Their insurance didn't cover it anymore. They can't afford it and they're afraid to tell you. Or they were trying to get the money together to afford it. So it doesn't necessarily, don't go automatically right to diversion of the drug. This to me is the biggest take home point for the urine drug testing, other than I don't think we're doing it enough in our offices. But examples of metabolism of opioids. So codeine metabolizes into morphine, as well as heroin metabolizes into morphine, which morphine can metabolize into hydromorphone and codeine to hydrocodone, oxycodone to oxymorphone. So a drug might show up and you're thinking, oh boy, they're getting drugs from another place, they broke our contract. But again, this is about talking to your lab about in the time that the person last took the drug, because it may have metabolized into another drug. So another red flag case here, you decide not to request routine risk assessment for fear of creating conflict. Mrs. Lane and her family have been your patients for years. She has chronic headaches and back pain treatment. When you ask her to take a urine drug test, she becomes upset and accuses you of not trusting her. You decide against further risk assessment because you're concerned about damaging the relationship. Okay. So your action here is require all patients receiving opioids to follow a treatment plan and adhere to defined expectations. And this is my point about your office being important, your office staff being educated on your practice for opioid prescribing. If they have to do the opioid risk assessment tool and a urine drug test and a provider prescriber agreement on everybody, it's not going to be so odd to them, or you know, maybe sideways looks at the person you do request it on if you only request it on patients that you think are at high risk. Again, because it's not just about abuse, but misuse. And it's my personal opinion, but just having done geriatrics for so long, I would venture to say older adults are probably some of the biggest misusers of drugs. My sister-in-law's mother, every time she saw me, she'd be like, Annette, I'm down to a quarter of a pill now on my blood pressure pill. I'm doing fine, right? So she was so proud of weaning herself down on her blood pressure medication, right? Which is terrible misuse. I'd be like, Olga, man, you gotta talk to your doctor. But anyway, so they're the biggest risks, not abusing, but misusing. And that's why they might need the urine drug testing more than anybody in your practice. So our next part here, we'll talk about discontinuing medications. How do we discontinue them? And I'll have to tell you another story. My dad had a compression fracture of his back, and he ultimately, to get relief, to be functional at all, to get out of bed, he was up to a 75 mic patch to fentanyl by his doctor. Well, he felt good. And one day he just calls me up. He's like, Annette, oh my God, I'm sweating. I can't breathe. My heart's racing and I feel terrible. And I was like, what did you do? He's like, oh, I'm feeling so good. I just took that patch off. Okay, so did that mean he was addicted to it? He was certainly having withdrawal. It didn't mean he was addicted to it. It meant he was tolerant to it and had to be weaned down off the drug. So I'm like, go to your doctor. And they prescribed him a 50 mic patch, you know, for a week, then 25 mic patch for a week and got him off it. But that's the important thing about discontinuing drugs. And super important if you have a patient on long-acting opioids that comes to the hospital. Okay? So you don't want to just abruptly stop their medication. You will cause withdrawal symptoms, potentially DTs, right? Delirium tremens, withdrawal from the medication, and acute pain crisis. So you may create a pseudo-addiction where they're constantly asking for more medication. A lot of patients that are in the hospital that we label drug-seeking are actually pseudo-addicted because we're under-prescribing them and creating them a situation where they have to search for the drug, okay? So when you're, the time to discontinue opioids, the pain level decreases in a stable patient, so their pain's getting better. There's intolerable adverse events. They're not reaching their therapeutic goals. Your goal might have been that they can play golf again, and they're just not getting there. There are any misuse or aberrant behavior, which we've kind of already talked about what those are. So you taper the dose when discontinuing. So it minimizes withdrawal symptoms in opioid-dependent patients. And really, if they, right, we talked about when they're tolerant is after a week or so of opioid use. So if someone's been on a drug longer than a week, you're probably going to need to taper the dose to get them off of it. You can use a range of approaches from 10% dose reduction to week to 25 to 50% every few days. So it depends on the pain, the situation, but you're going to follow them closely through that. If they have an opioid use disorder or failed taper, refer to addiction specialist. So they're failing the taper. They you don't really think they need it anymore. Their function's fine. Their pain should be getting better. They might have lost control of the drug and steered toward addiction, and they might need a specialist. So counseling and relaxation strategies are needed. So they have to continue their non-pharmacological interventions through this, right? That they're sleeping well, that they're doing their yoga, whatever helped them get through the pain to begin with, they should continue. All right, so our pearls from this chapter here, establish informed consent and a patient-provider agreement at the beginning, educate the whole team, patients, families, and caregivers. Refer if necessary, anticipate opioid-induced respiratory depression and constipation, follow patients closely during times of dose adjustment, periodically evaluate functional outcomes, and discontinue opioids slowly and safely. Just in reading this summary, I just want to reinforce the treatment of the constipation. So there's opioid receptors in the gut. So the patient will be constipated. It's not a symptom they get tolerant to. They will always be constipated. So the hand that writes for the opioid should write for the bowel medication. And I constantly see just Docusate or Colace written for. That's a softener. That's not good enough. I like to use Sena-Cat with Docusate or Sena-S, and you can go up to 4 tablets twice a day. But I, you know, older adults don't like to take pills, so usually I'll go 1 twice a day, then 2 twice a day. If that doesn't work, I go quickly to lactulose or sorbitol. It's cheap, it's a liquid, it's not a pill, so patients sometimes are more compliant with it, and it works great. But they need something for motility, not just softening. And Kate Galluzzi, who's one of the authors of this, who I've lectured with, she always said, don't create mush without the push, right? So not that funny. All right, so red flag. So Donald has been prescribed oxycodone for 6 months to treat back pain. His urine drug test at 6 months comes back negative in all areas. He tells you that he's taking his medications. So you're like, well, dude, why is not showing up in your urine? So you do not discharge a patient at the first action. Contact the lab, discuss the test, and any metabolite specimen integrity issue. Was there a problem? Was it not the right temperature to be tested, for example? Ask, is this the right lab test? Repeat the urine drug test and document is everything. And document everything and discuss with the patient. So one negative test doesn't mean you discharge the patient. And then patients who are not who they appear, Tom has back pain. He's managed by taking oxycodone 40 milligrams twice a day, but wants to decrease his dose when he can. Thus, he requests only 20 milligram pills. He often brings in unused meds to show how he's trying to reduce his dose. He resists any change. All right, so our classic older adult who doesn't want to take medications. Don't allow the patient to taper on their own. Okay, they just might not understand the withdrawal that they could go through. Create an endpoint for the taper. See patients once a week with a 7-day supply and tapering until they are out of opioids. Document teaching patients comments about the plan, urine drug testing, pill counts, non-pharmacological modalities for pain management, and their adherence to the plan. Right? So document, taper, and continue to count pills and things to make sure they're following what you wanted, okay? So special populations, the older adult is more at risk for respiratory depression for sure, but I've often seen that the pain in the elderly is undertreated because of the worry about this. But if you started low, titrated slowly, and switched them to long-acting when appropriate, when they're opioid tolerant, it's still a very low risk. But monitor at times of initiation and titration of dose. Look at their other meds. You have to know their other meds before you can prescribe something. If they say, oh, I take this other little white pill, I wouldn't prescribe them a long-acting opioid until I knew what it was. You know, it might be Xanax or something that can interfere with their respirations as well. There are falls risk, cognitive changes. Psychosocial status can affect their ability to take the medication. Can they afford it? Who else is living in the home? Is there more risk of diversion because of grandkids living in the home, for example? Reduce the starting dose, a third to half the usual dose in debilitated non-opioid tolerant patients. Start low, go slow. Patient and caregiver reliably discuss risk of diversion, that they're going to lock up the medication, for example. Women with childbearing potential, 40% of women are prescribed opioids that are of childbearing age. We know very little about opioid use in pregnancy. I would refer them to a specialist for sure during that time if they're pregnant. If not, talk to them about all the risks or if they're planning to become pregnant. The pregnant patient, I would refer to a specialist. I'm not trained to treat them. I'm not comfortable treating them, but they have to, again, it's all about risk versus benefit, their pain, what other interventions might help, and the risk to the newborn as well if they do have chronic opioid treatment throughout their pregnancy. So children and adolescents, only fentanyl is the drug, fentanyl is the only drug studied in children right now, but it's very judicious use of immediate relief for brief therapy. This again needs a specialist to use long-acting opioids because there's not much data on use in children. I would have a pediatric palliative care doc on board right away if I had a patient who was a child who has experienced that level of pain. So here's another red flag case. 73-year-old Thelma comes into the clinic accompanied by her grandson who is in the exam room with you and Thelma. Thelma says her oxycodone 10 milligram tablets every 4 hours is no longer working for her back pain. She asks for more medicine. You ask the grandson to leave the exam room so you can examine her privately. So based on her exam findings and her request for more medication, you do a urine drug test, a PDMP check, discuss whether or not it's possible for her grandson or another family member might be using her medications. Don't give opioids to another person. Now, you know, to me, this case doesn't scream, why would you go right to abuse or misuse? But that's, if she's functional or she's, it's a dose that you think really should be working, it's reasonable to at least ask her. But you do urine drug screening and PDMP just like you would on anybody if you're worried about misuse or abuse. So know your federal and state laws. Some states have different prescribing rules. There's different rules about the PDMPs, but here's some websites to help you understand. And then the prescription drug monitoring program, not all federally licensed facilities report, so there might be some places a person might get a drug and they actually don't report to this, but individual state laws determine who can access it, which drugs scheduled are monitored, whether the prescribers are required to register or not, whether prescribers are required to access from one in certain circumstances, whether you're supposed to, whether they're present to the prescriber. So sometimes, like in Michigan, I'll get a report that a patient I prescribed opioids to 6 months ago is getting more opioids from somewhere else, let's say. So I get a report of when a patient I saw is getting opioids. In some states, send a report to the patient whenever their record's been accessed by somebody, okay? So all state laws are very different, but I encourage you to register for yours and encourage you to use it. So what it does is give, some are available 24/7 online. Within minutes, you can get a record of the patient's use, which pharmacy they got it filled at, who prescribed it, if they paid cash or not, And if you have a patient that's, you're like, I don't believe what you're telling me, and you can print a list and say, listen, I have a list right here that last week you got some oxycodone at CVS. So it's a really good tool right up front to say, I don't believe what you're telling me. Cannabis, I just leave this in here because I just want you to be aware of it. It's now commonly prescribed in Michigan, where I am, is for medical use, but it's everywhere. I mean, it's so easy to get, but just know, again, it's, I think it's a whole lecture in and of itself to know how to use it, I mean, how to prescribe it. I know there's a four-hour course you have to attend in order to prescribe it, at least in Michigan and in Pennsylvania, where I gave this talk last, but you want to know if your patients are on it. And you'll have to decide personally if you're going to prescribe long-acting opioids to a patient using this, especially if they're using it for chronic pain appropriately as medical marijuana, and you don't think they're abusing it, but they're using it appropriately. But that it's something you need to ask about and be aware of. So there's some scientific evidence about it. If you're comfortable treating patients that use medical marijuana and you're prescribing them long-acting opioids, again, just know that they're using it. Know the scientific evidence behind it. Set treatment goals. Make it part of your patient prescriber agreement. Document everything, your discussions, regular reevaluation, urine drug testing. If you're saying, I'm only going to prescribe this to you if you don't use this, a urine drug testing randomly might help with that as well. And then, of course, edibles are the fastest growing delivery system, so they don't have to be smoking it. There's not much data on the use of opioids in cannabis. Okay, so you guys are doing good. We're more than halfway through. So patient counseling documents, another tool for your toolbox, for your office. And this can be something that can be part of your EMR that you print right off and give it to them, and it meets your criteria for patient education. Hopefully you go over it with them, but your staff in your office could go over it with them as well. This is just an example of one here. There's a website there to download or order hard copies. But what it does is explain specific information for the drug you're prescribing, encourages them to take drug as prescribed, adhere to the dose that you prescribe, how to handle missed doses, so what do I do if I missed a dose, and then notify you if your pain's not controlled, and call prescriber for treatment of side effect management. So it educates them on all of that, as well as encourage them to read the medication guide that comes with the medication from the pharmacy as well. And it explained that they should tell you every medication that they're taking. They shouldn't abruptly discontinue the medication, explain the risk of falls, driving, heavy machinery use, sharing or selling opioids can lead to deaths, so they shouldn't share them, and certainly should, again, let you know if they're taking any other medications or any other opioids. And then it discusses respiratory depression as well. So, and they should be stored in a safe place. It's really crucial, in a lockbox even, in their room, especially if there's small children around or even somebody who might steal the medication. And it might not be their own grandkids. It could be if their grandkids are coming over with friends. Tell the patient and caregivers medications, should be locked up. That you'll periodically discuss benefits, side effects of the medication, and the need for reevaluation. So this education tool will explain all of this. That would take a long time in your office to explain it. You want to talk about it, but if you give it to them written as well, you're meeting the standard for educating your patient. So of course, again, reinforce, repeat as part of this lecture, but never break, chew, crush, or snort an oral long-acting medication. For sure. And then you shouldn't really use it with any other CNS depressants or alcohol. If there's any concern over overdosing, call 911. And then it discusses some of the signs there. Naloxone, this is a new slide they added to the slide deck probably in the last 6 months, because we can prescribe naloxone now. If you're prescribing a long-acting opioid to a patient that you're worried might have some significant adverse side effects, you can prescribe them some naloxone. Tell their family how to administer it. Most EMS now are carrying naloxone with them, but you It can be a nasal spray or injectable, and we can prescribe this. So you discuss an overdose plan, involve and train family, friends, caregivers, check with the pharmacy if they're prescribing, and check expiration dates, and then certainly still call 911 if they're concerned. So what's becoming more and more common now, a lot of long-acting opiates are being mixed with something like naloxone, which is abuse deterrent. So if they take the medication appropriately and swallow it whole, they'll get the pain medication, but if they crush it, then it releases naloxone as well and renders the opioid either completely ineffective or certainly much less effective, and defers much of the side effects of it as well. So it's just one option in a patient that you're significantly concerned potentially about misusing. So educate parents that or grandparents that you're giving the medication to discuss opioid use with their teens. Just a study here on substances parents have discussed with teens. Mostly we discuss alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, but only one in four really discuss pain relievers not prescribed by their own doctor, and to be careful taking it. And I thought there was a slide on it, and we'll probably get to it, but Kate, who I lectured with that I told you about earlier, Kate Galuzzi, she had her daughter go to a party in college, and it was called a fishbowl party, where they said, bring whatever pills you can find, and they put them in a bowl when they get to the party, and they grab a drink, and they grab a couple pills, and just take them. That's a relatively common thing now. My kids are in college, too, and they said, oh, yeah, I've heard of that. So patients go to their grandparents' or their parents' house and grab some pills out of the cupboard, right? That's how they got them. So have a discussion with your patients to talk to their teens, talk to their parents of their kids' friends about appropriate storage of medications. So note how many pills are in each prescription, keep track of dosage and refills, make sure everyone in the home knows these are instructions that you would give your patient, and then keep meds in a safe place, encourage parents of your teens' friends to secure their prescriptions as well, and then be sure to discard medications, which we'll talk about. So disposal, the best way to do this is, there's a new disposal act, expands ways for patients to dispose of unwanted expired medications. The best way to dispose it is a drug take-back day. You may have heard of those, but there's collection receptacles. They can call the DEA to find out where they can take the medication. Some come with mail back packages and take-back events, where there might be a day where you can go to the police department in your city and take all of your medications that are expired. Just different examples. But if none of those are available, one option is to take drugs out of their original container mixed with an undesirable substance. So here they show it with coffee grounds, but Kate was always like, I don't know, morphine and some coffee, like that'd be not so undesirable. But it usually is like kitty litter, especially dirty kitty litter, mixing it with and something, but that's in a plastic bag in the trash, not just dumped in the trash, but in a plastic bag with an undesirable substance, and then remove any identifying labels, of course. So that's an option to get rid of it. Flush down the sink is an option, but when I lectured in California, California said it's against state law to flush them down the toilet. But it's still okay in many states, but that's really the least desirable option to get rid of them. But this was something I can't say until I saw this slide deck that I ever discussed with my patients ever, how to get rid of their expired medications. Okay? Get rid of medications as soon as they're no longer needed. I mean, I do home visits, and I go to patients' homes, and we all know that they have medications, all different kinds of medications that haven't been taking for 2 years, and they've been expired for three. And so we don't like to get rid of medications, but get rid of all of them as soon as they're not needed, whether they're expired or not. For a patch, you fold it in half so it's sticky sides meet, then can flush down the toilet. Don't place used or unused patches. Unneeded patches in the trash, okay? So put the sticky sides together, it renders it ineffective. So Pearls for Pectus, use formal tools that we already talked about, emphasize safe storage and disposal to patients and caregivers, and consider co-prescribing naloxone. Oh, here it is. I knew it was coming. So your patient's daughter stole her father's opioids from bedside drawer to take a fishbowl party. Her best friend consumed a mix of opioids and alcohol and died of an overdose. This is such a dramatic example of appropriate use. And there's, Kate knew a story too of a patient, an older guy who had a fentanyl patch on, and he had it on his chest, and he was holding his two-year-old grandson, and they both fell asleep. And the grandson actually ingested some of the fentanyl patch and died from just laying on his chest and sucking in some of the patch and medication while they were both sleeping. So you have to be super careful about the medications in young children. Drug class considerations. So know your drug interactions, the pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics of the medication. CNS depressions can potentiate sedation and respiratory depression. You can't use them with MAOIs really, although if you could, but be very, very careful. Methadone and buprenorphine can prolong the QT interval. These are just some examples of some of the significant complications in the pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics. Some ER and long-acting products rapidly release opioid, can dose dump when exposed to alcohol. So you really, that's what I'm saying, pick one, two, or three drugs that you're really comfortable with, you read the product information, and you really understand their risks, side effects, and can adequately educate your patients about it as well. Some can reduce the efficacy of diuretics, and then the CYP enzymes can increase or lower blood levels of some episodes depending on the drug. Transdermal forms, if a patient is having fevers, or even in a super hot climate where they work outside and they might sweat a lot, it can render the patch ineffective or can be absorbed faster at a higher body temperature. It's absorbed faster. So you have to be super careful. Again, prescribe that appropriately to the right patient. They should rotate the location of the application. Prepare the skin. Don't shave the skin, but clip the hair. You don't shave the skin because you might cause micro tears and then you get blood absorption rather than transdermal absorption of the medication. Monitor patients with fever. Again, we've already talked about that. Metal foil backings are not safe for use in MRIs. One of the buprenorphine patches has a metal foil backing. For buccal products, the film should not be applied. That's the hardly ever used medication. So drug interactions common with other CNS depressants. Reduce initial dose of one or both agents. So if they're already on a CNS depressant, you're going to prescribe this. Reduce both doses. It can enhance neuromuscular blocking, action of skeletal muscle relaxants, increase respiratory depression. I was telling the geriatrics group yesterday, the new hospital that I'm at, any trauma patient, because I do geriatric trauma consults, as I told you, if they have any sort of fracture at all, they get Robaxin 3 times a day. I mean, I don't even know where it comes from. This is happening every single day at a very good hospital that I practice at. And I'm trying to just figure out the surgeon's mind. And then, of course, they have a fracture, so they're going to be on an opioid as well. So we just see tons of delirium, and it's very interesting to me. But if they're on skeletal muscle relaxants, be careful with opioids as well. Avoid concurrent use of partial agonists or mixed agonist-antagonists. And then certainly anticholinergic medications can increase risk of side effects. So know all of these formulations for the specific drug that you prescribe. In summary, assess patients for treatment with immediate release and long-acting opioids. Initiate therapy, modify dose, discontinue use of opioids. Monitor ongoing therapy with immediate release and extended release long-acting opioids. Counsel patients and caregivers, and know your medications. Here is the website, if you guys want the website. I know that you are going to do the test online, but I want to go through the questions just so either if you guys want to either write down the answers or just be familiar with them so when you do the test it'll be a little bit easier. I all the answers. We discussed every single one of the questions. And again, there's not a minimum pass that you have to take, that you have to get with it, but I just like to go through the test anyways. So our first question here, among the risk factors contained in screening tools for predicting aberrant drug-related behavior in patients receiving opioids for chronic pain are family and personal history of substance abuse, legal problems, history of pre-adolescent sexual abuse, psychological problems, and an age of 16 to 45 years. Okay, that's the answer to that one. Which of the following is most important to consider when determining a starting dose of an extended-release long-acting opioid? It's assessment of individual needs, okay? A 55-year-old man who's being treated for chronic low back pain after undergoing laminectomy comes for follow-up evaluation. A trial of oxycodone extended-release therapy is planned. Completion of which of the following is the most appropriate step before initiation of therapy? So this is question three. You're going to do a patient and prescriber agreement before, which is answer C. Are you handing out the test? Oh, no. Okay, sorry. So for a 63-year-old woman with a history of spinal stenosis and peripheral neuropathy secondary to breast cancer treatment, comes for evaluation because of increasingly severe back pain. She reports that the pain started 2 weeks ago after doing yard work. She underwent chemotherapy 12 years ago. Medications include an opioid. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step? So this is number four. So she has an acute change in her pain. So the most appropriate next step is not an automatic increase in her opioid, which is a lot of times in my hospice patients, the nurses will call me and say, oh, they have this new pain, Dr. Karen, can I start morphine? Like, wait a minute, have they had it before? What was the mechanism of injury? Does it radiate? Go through all the history. But so you want it, on this patient, you're gonna reevaluate the underlying medical condition, right? They have an acute change in their pain, you're not just gonna increase the medication. You want to investigate it. So that's the answer for that one. And then number five, use of extended-release long-acting opioids in pediatric patients less than 18 years of age deserves special consideration because the safety and effectiveness of most opioids has not been established in this population. Okay. And then number six, a 59-year-old with long-standing hypertension and stage 3 chronic kidney disease continues treatments with disease-modifying anti-rheumatoid drugs for rheumatoid arthritis. Recently, she's exhibited increasing pain and further functional decline due to progression of RA and osteoarthritis of the hips, knees, and feet. She wants to remain as functional as possible. So there's, which is the following next best step? So the answer really is to start with the immediate release medication. So prescribe oxycodone, immediate release, 5 milligrams Q4 hours PRN. Some of the other choices here are acetaminophen, but the dose that's written is too high because of the max dose per day of acetaminophen. Duloxetine would be for neuropathic pain, so that's not the answer. Extended release morphine sulfate, you would not start because it's a new initiation in an opioid naive patient, you start immediate release. And then ibuprofen, 600 milligrams Q4 hours is a choice, but that's, you will kill the patient with that dose, right? So an inappropriate method to dispose of unused opioid medication is D, dispose of medication in the regular trash. And eight, the most appropriate reason to patients should be counseled to never break, cut, chew, or crush a long-acting opioid tablet or is because the patient may die. Nine, to avoid inadvertent overdose and death, a patient should be counseled to avoid co-administration of an extended-release long-acting opioid with which of the following, and the answer is alcohol. We stressed that during the talk. Which of the following extended-release long-acting opioids is most likely to induce a peak respiratory depression that occurs later and persists longer than the analgesic effect? And methadone is the answer. We specifically talked about that. All right, we're almost done. So when using an equal analgesic table to rotate opioids other than methadone, an important step to account for incomplete cross-tolerance among mu opioids includes reduce the calculated equal analgesic dose by 25 to 50%. And number 12, a 72-year-old grandfather with severe persistent abdominal pain from colon cancer has been taking an immediate-release opioid every 4 hours around the clock. He and his wife care for their two young grandchildren, and he states that he can no longer help with their care due to his pain level. He wants to increase the dose of his medication and asks what else he might do to control the pain. Which of the following supports the addition of an extended-release opioid for treatment of this patient? More consistent plasma concentrations. 67-year-old female with severe knee osteoarthritis has been converted from an immediate-release opioid to an extended-release opioid for pain control. She has chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, but made her a poor surgical candidate. In addition to extended-release opioid, which second prescription would be most appropriate to dispense to her? So this is an older person who you're starting long-acting opioids, and the answer is naloxone, right, just in case she had side effects. And then a positive result of hydromorphone of a urine drug toxicology test for a patient on prescribed morphine can be interpreted as maybe a morphine metabolite. Okay, that's the answer.